In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise unto Allah, who hath sent down unto His bondmen the Book, and hath not replaced therein any crookedness, straightforward that it may warn of a severe violence from before Him, and bring glad tidings to the believers who work righteous works, that theirs shall be a goodly hire. They will abide therein forever, and that it may warn those who say, God hath taken a son. No knowledge thereof have they, nor have their fathers. A deus is the word that cometh out their mouths. They say not, but a lie. Happily thou art going to kill thyself over their footsteps, if they believe not in the discourse out of sorrow. Verily we have made whatsoever is on the earth as an adornment thereof, that we may prove to them which of them is best in work. And verily, we are going to make whatsoever is thereon a soil there. Knowest thou that the people of the cave and the inscription were of our sign, a wonder? Recall what times the youth betook themselves to the cave and said, Our Lord, vouchsafe unto us mercy from before thee, and prepare for us in our affair a right course. Wherefore we put a covering over their ears in the cave for a number of years. Thereafter, we raised them up that we might know which of the two parties was best at reckoning the time that had tarried. We recount unto thee their tidings with truth. Verily, they were certain youths who believed in the Lord, and we increased them in guidance. And we braced their hearts when they stood forth and said, Our Lord is the Lord of the heavens and the earth. Never we shall call upon a God besides Him. For then we shall be saying an abomination. These our people have taken for themselves gods besides Him. Wherefore bring they not for them an authority manifest? And who doth greater wrong than he who fabricated against God a lie? And now when ye have withdrawn from them and that which they worship except God, betake yourselves to the cave. Your Lord will unfold for you some of His mercy and will prepare for you of your affair. Easier.
MashaAllah.
We're also gathered here today to remind ourselves of the lofty values that Imam Khomeini stood for, the values of justice, righteousness, brotherhood, and faith. We are glad to have our respected guest here, Maulana Sayyid Zaki Bakri, Brother Zafar Bangash, who's also one of the hosts, and Mr. Eric Wahlberg. I welcome you on behalf of the organizers, volunteers, and attendees. To this evening is filled with many programs for every age group. We'll be having a quiz competition for the youth. We'll also have poets come up and recite their poems about Imam Khomeini in between the speeches. And as well, please don't forget to look at the art being displayed in the back over there that has been made and submitted by some kids for this evening. The winners of all these competitions, as well as the poetry competition, will be announced at the end of the program. A laptop, a camera, gift cards, and more are waiting for the hardworking participants and winners. Just to be clear, I'll also be participating in the quiz competition, and I don't know the questions or the answers, or at least not all of them. Our target tonight is to finish before the Maghrib prayer so that you can pray Maghrib in your own mosque or homes and can attend other late-night programs. Without further ado, I'd like to invite Mr. Eric Wahlberg to the stage.
So Mr. Eric Wahlberg is known worldwide as a journalist specializing in the Middle East, Central Asia, and Russia. He has spent 6 years at the foremost Cairo newspaper, Al Ahram, and he's a regular contributor to Counterpunch, Dissident Voice, Global Research, and RTTV. His book, Postmodern Imperialism, which is published in Chinese, Turkish, and Russian, and he's a graduate of University of Toronto and Cambridge in economics. His book is available over here for $20.
I did my book launch. This is the third book that I've written about things anti-imperialist and Islamic to some extent. The first book was more just about 20th century imperialism. But the second one was dealing with Islamic revival through the last two centuries. And this one is more dealing with the political side of Islam. Can I? There, okay. First, if we're talking about Islam, we should get terms clear. I'm speaking now to a Muslim group, so it's a little bit out of my league to try to give explanations. But this was how I started my talk at Beit Zaytun. A few days ago, because most people there were secular and just Western. But of course, we all know Islamism, it's the fundamentalism, the revival of Islamic fundamentalism that started in the 19th century. The first, what we could call Islamist leader was Wahhab in Saudi Arabia. Now, this movement that became Wahhabism is very strictly focused on the physical nature of imitating Muhammad in his dress, in food, just the way you hold your hands, those kinds of simple things. The idea being that if you look a lot like Muhammad and act like him, that you will be achieving a higher sense of spirituality. Now there is much more to spirituality than just looks. Wahhabis could get away with this kind of quietist Islamism. Quietism meaning no politics. They could get away with this in the 19th century and even up until recently. In the 19th century, Saudi Arabia was a windswept, barren, desert, isolated, of no strategic interest to the West, had no resources. Even after oil was found in 1930 and it became more strategically significant as a place in the middle of the new great game that was going on, the U.S. was happy to agree with the Saudi leaders and the Wahhabis to continue their very narrow and, I won't be too negative, their very narrow view of Islam as long as they let the U.S. continue whatever policies it was pursuing. And we see this right up until today that in Yemen, I mean, this is going a step beyond that quietism. The Saudis have actually been bombing. In the past, they haven't actually attacked other Muslims, although they did send troops into Bahrain. But bombing their neighbors is a new step, and that's at the U.S. behest. So you can see that this Wahhabism is finally breaking down under the stress of the terrible policies of the U.S. and the terrible situation. So there's the Wahhabism. There's also the Salafi, who are really not much different than the Wahhabis. They're another strictly fundamentalist, not interested in political Islam, although that did change with the occupation of Palestine in the 1960s and the writings of Qutb, the Muslim Brotherhood radical scholar, and with with the Afghan uprising in 1979, these Salafi came in great numbers as jihadi to fight to liberate Afghanistan from the Soviet occupation. Well, that tragic period finally ended, and they were then dispersed around the world. And we have to keep in mind, of course, the U.S. financed them, and that they wouldn't exist without the U.S. backing of that war in Afghanistan. So the U.S. really was getting its just desserts, you could say, because these jihadis started to undertake bombings and acts against Westerners, specifically Westerners, and then when it came to the bombing of the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya, they killed hundreds of innocent Africans that without any focus. I mean, you killed a handful of American embassy workers, but it was just a terrible act. I think that's quite clear. And then it culminates in 9/11, this mass act. Now, who actually did 9/11? That's a good question. You can see my take on it. I have a chapter, Who Done It? And I just say it's really not clear. There were jihadis involved. Who was actually financing and logistically carrying out, that's still not that clear. Okay, so, but the Islamists that are closest to my heart are the Brotherhood, Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. They had a great leader, Al-Banna, who embraced political Islam in a very sensible way to encourage charity, to encourage the principles of Islam in the everyday lives of people. And they quickly became very popular. By the 1930s and 1940s, if there had been legitimate elections in Egypt, they would have been swept to power, just as they were 70 years later in 2011. Now, and in fact, I like to, when I think of the Muslim Brotherhood, I think of Zafar Bangash too. I think he's a very, has that kind of credibility and is a very devout and at the same time practical political figure. And I look also at Imam Khomeini. He was a great leader who was inspired by the Brotherhood and read the writings of Qutb in the 60s and other writers, Maulad, in the Pakistani, Maudouni. So, and I'm very pleased to be able to speak in the Imam Khomeini's honor. Just as an aside, I was in Iran last year for a conference, an anti-Zionist conference. And I met some wonderful people, very, very bright, articulate, anti-Zionist, but at the same time not racist, or as the West claims. And there's no sense of terrorist desire there. So that the Iranian model is very similar, I think, to the heritage of the Brotherhood. Now, I know I've got some critics of here of the Brotherhood. We could, if we have a question and answer maybe at the end, or we could talk, because I was living in Egypt right up until 2012, and I knew Brotherhood people, and I saw the kind of politics and the difficulties they were having, and I still think they did a good job in spite of whatever problems they faced and mistakes they may have made. It's not an easy job. I don't think it was a golden opportunity, as Ali Malha said. I think it was an opportunity loaded with dangers and almost impossible to... I think Zafar actually commented that if he was in that position, he wouldn't have accepted trying to take actual power, even with a strong majority, because... There were just too many wolves out there waiting to, get a hold and tear you apart, which of course is what's happened since. Okay, so there we have pretty well the variety of Islam. There's a lot of different things going on within the world of Islam. That's quite clear. Now, is it a clash of civilizations? Well, of course it is. The civilization mean the culture that binds the society together. That's one of the. That's probably the first thing that attracted me to Islam, was that there is such a strong sense of culture. And then when I realized this, I started to look at Islamic civilization, that it was just had a spectacular history. And I realize today, I'm very optimistic in spite of the horrible things in the Middle East. Islam is very powerful, and it's not going to go away. And even U.S. Strategists, they realize this. A CIA agent joked that it was easier to convince a Soviet to become an agent than to convince a Muslim. That the Soviets just take them to Kmart, and they're all excited. Whereas Islamists or Muslims, you take them there and it's haram. Or maybe they like it, but they know that they better keep they don't want to be corrupted. So there was a very, very big difference, and that continues today. The Pentagon, General Nagati, he said, we have not defeated them. We don't even understand them. So, I mean, that's pretty. But then he went on to say, what we need is we need our business professors to look at their marketing strategies to see how we can undermine them. Now, you know, the kind of nonsense of combining black and white like that is. Also, Tenet, the CIA head, writes in his memoirs, he was very impressed that a Muslim would say, you fear death, we embrace it. So he said, it's like, how do you deal with people that are so strong-willed? How are we doing for time, Zafar? Should I wrap up now? Just a few comments about what's the spiritual basis for the resistance? Well, it's not just Islam that is all religions resist imperialism, and because imperialism undermines ethics. It destroys social fabric. It takes away people's beliefs. So no religion actually likes imperialism, I don't think, or capitalism and the international variant of capitalist imperialism. But only Islam seems to be a resilient force. And after all that it's been through, it's stronger than ever. You know, you kill thousands of Taliban freedom fighters, and the next day there's more out there. And it's very saddens me. I'm in great awe of the Taliban, even though I never really liked some of their policies. But, you know, who cares what I think? You know, they should be left in peace. They should, they can evolve towards what society they want. And this is something that I was suggesting to the secularists I was talking to, and perhaps it's appropriate here for you. There's no rigid type of Islamist. There are beliefs, and there are people adapting to contexts. When the context is very, very stressful, you end up with some, and there's a collapse of social order, you find something like ISIS arising. I don't call them terrorists. I call them jihadists. And the same with Hamas. Hamas, who suffered, they had a terrible fight with ISIS in Jerusalem in 2009. And yet, just recently, the Hamas spokesman Zahari, I think it's Zahari, I don't have my notes here, but Zahar, he said, we don't use this word terrorist. This is a word that is used in the press to undermine, to distract. It's a political term, politically loaded term. If we don't agree, we still will not call ISIS terrorists. And we will not take part in the U.S. War against ISIS, the bombing and all of that. So I think that's that kind of principled position is very impressive to me, that they're not joining the, some Muslims are supporting U.S. and their activities. And I think that's outrageous, you know, that you can take a principled position and just keep it clear that the U.S. is doing, right from the start and today, everything it does is the opposite of what's even going to help them. They end up shooting themselves in the foot with all their bombings and interference, and it's quite clear. The U.S. has to get out. I think we all agree on that. Now, there have been some new developments, too. This I mentioned the bombings of the Saudis in Yemen. This is a new development. The Saudi Wahhabis have always said, oh, we don't involve in politics. We're nice and clean. We're just following Mohammed's path. Whereas now they're being pushed by their masters into actually doing some of the dirty work. And that just shows you how weak the U.S. has become, that it's got to call on these allies to do its bombings for it. The same happened in Syria. Couldn't move into Syria the way it did into Iraq and Afghanistan. So it's in a more defensive position. Also, their cooperation with Iran, to some extent. I mean, it's not quite clear. I think there's more going on there than we see. But there is a step towards détente, if you like, with Iran. And I think that, again, shows you that maybe they're finally waking up, that they're harming themselves more by continuing this standoff. Okay, I think I don't want to go on too long. I hope that we can have a chance later to discuss some of these points. I'm happy to take on Ali's, and I'm sure other people have some good points to make.
Then we have to organize a debate between you and me.
And we have all three questions actually about his speech, and those who answer it will get a Tim Hortons gift card. So the first question: by whom was Islamic fundamentalism created by in the 19th century?
Do you want me to answer?
No. It's questions for the crowd. So who created Islamic fundamentalism in the 19th century? Yes. The second question. It is easy to convert a Soviet to an agent than Muslims. Who was this said by?
He's saying George Tenet, that's right. I heard George Tenet too from down there.
I'm going to re-ask the question, or re-ask the statement that the question was based on. Who in his memoirs wrote that Muslims accuse us, they say, you're afraid of death. We embrace it.
Someone said it out there earlier. Just say it again.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Well done.
I'll move on to the second question. Or the third question, sorry. All religions resist blank. What word fits inside that blank? Yes. Thank you.